This is Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirits Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Brian Diaz here with you. The unofficial start of the weekend here in the Crescent City. Hey, as you know, everyone is welcome on the NOLA Drink Show. Anyone can serve with us as we explore the world of drink and food in New Orleans and beyond together. And we here at the show would be proud to have you do so. Hey, friends, thanks for tuning in today, however you're listening. If you're here on the radio on Thursday, if you're catching the podcast down the road, I appreciate that. Of course, podcast is always available on iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn, and now on Stitcher. We're also streaming radio on TuneIn and I think a few other places. So there you go. You can catch a show wherever you want and wherever you're listening. Again, I always really, really appreciate it. Whether you're overseas in Japan, big shout out to those folks. Whether you're over in Europe or here in the United States or right here in Southeast Louisiana and in the great city of New Orleans, wherever you are, thanks for tuning into the show today. Friends, as you know, the big event last week here in town was Tales of the Cocktail. Man, what an event. I'm just glad to say that I survived. If you caught the show, we did it live from the studio last week, and it was a lot of fun. It was right in the middle, the Thursday, which is more or less smack dab in the middle of Tales of the Cocktail, and that was a good laugh. We did mention that we did a lot of coverage of the event, so we taped a whole bunch of stuff, all kinds of cool things, and we're going to be rolling that out over the coming weeks, different interviews we did, a lot of liquor producers, spirit producers, liqueur producers, these sorts of things, and some other folks, some interesting importers and that sort of stuff. So be on the lookout for that. A lot of great interviews, so I was really happy to be able to talk to a huge amount of folks, go do a bunch of things. We'll talk about that in the next segment, a little bit of a retrospect there on Tales of the Cocktail, which should be pretty good. A little bit of news, friends. Sad news here, really. Cafe Henri, which is the cafe sort of bistro that opened up in the Bywater. And that was done by the gang at Cure, Neil Bodenheimer and Nick Dietrich and those guys. They run Cure on Ferret Street, and they also run Cane and Table there on Decatur in the Quarter. Two great places. Cafe Henri was a very nice place as well. They are closed. I believe they have closed. And, you know, we talk a lot about this on the show, friends, that about the restaurant industry. You can reference some of the back episodes of the podcast. Our frequent guest, Robert LeBlanc, along with others, Sean Joseph of Kenton's, Alex Harrell of Angeline. Very honest guys and talking about the restaurant business. It's tough. It's tough right now. The independent sit-down establishment is a tough gig to be in, not just in New Orleans, but really anywhere. And unfortunately, Cafe Henri is the latest victim of all of this. Neil Bodenheimer there, as I mentioned, Neil posted a very heartfelt post on Facebook the other day announcing the closure. And, you know, it's tough. People lose their jobs. I know that's a big concern of them. They're trying to find jobs for the team. But he talks a lot about the learning curve. And the Bywater, as we know, has proven, we've talked about this quite a bit on the show, proven to be a tough neighborhood. We've had a lot of places recently, Oxalis, not too long ago, Booties, where Oxalis was prime, whole bunch of places in that little area continued to go out of business. And as Neil says, sort of underestimating the dynamics of the neighborhood, short-term rental market, of course, we're talking about Airbnb, that sort of thing. It's tough, maybe missing the mark with understanding who your locals are. And in a place like the Bywater, and in months like the summer, locals are what keep you in business. This is what we've talked about a lot on the show. And it's tough in the Bywater. They maybe missed the mark a little bit in their audience for those who are residents there. But again, talking about some of the loss of the film business, these sorts of things that have affected the overall economy of the city and the Bywater neighborhood in particular has been a victim of this. And as I mentioned again, the short-term rental market has been tough. So there, you know, it's a tough thing. And I guess what I'm saying here too, is if you're thinking about opening a restaurant, look at a situation like Cafe Henri where you're in a neighborhood that might be a little tough and take heed and learn some of these lessons that these people have learned before moving forward. And really on that front, I wanted to mention also some other interesting news in the restaurant world over there in Lakeview, the Lakeview neighborhood here in New Orleans, long time establishment, Lakeview Harbor, which is a burger spot right there on Harrison, is closing down when their lease runs out at the end of January of next year. It became official on Friday. This was first reported by Ian McNulty of The Advocate. And this, I had heard rumblings of this going back a little while, that this was actually going to be the case, but it's come to pass. And so Lakeview Harbor, it's been there since, I believe, 93 or so. And what's going to basically happen, they're saying that they're going to move. And Sean Toops is the proprietor now. He was the brother of, pardon me for 1 second, Tony Henderson, who actually started Port of Call. And we'll get to that story in just a second. I apologize here. Don't want to jump ahead of myself. What's going to happen then in that space? Lakeview Harbor is going to move. And they want to stick around Lakeview, which I appreciate. They said Lakeview is what made us, so that's where they want to be. Makes a lot of sense. What's going to move into the current spot at 911 Harrison Avenue? Two brothers, Blake and Brandon Bennett, are opening up a new restaurant. They are the guys that own Andy's Bistro in Metairie. They want to open up a burger-oriented joint in that spot. So keep score with me here. So that's fine. And they're looking at opening in the spring. They're going to do some renovations on the property. So there you go. Now, also, Mark Schenck, who was a founder with Sean Toops, opening up Lakeview Harbor. Actually, excuse me, his brother, Tony Henderson. He is also planning on opening up a burger joint somewhere. And he is also eyeing locations there in Lakeview. Okay, so we're now talking, if you kept score with me, maybe three different places. Schenck's place, the Andy's Bistro folks' place, and then wherever Sean Toops moves from Lakeview. This is sort of what we're getting at here, and let me back this up a little bit. The famous place, Port of Call, of course, there on Esplanade. Sean Toops' brother was the late Tony Henderson. As I mentioned, he was a manager at Port of Call, and he and Schenck then went and opened, Mark Schenck opened Lakeview Harbor, and then Sean Toops started working there early in 97 or so, I believe, something like that, in the 90s, and then eventually became a partner. So there's sort of the family tree there, if you followed me. But point being that we're talking about potentially three burger spots, a new Lakeview Harbor, the Bennett's Place, and Schenck's Place, all opening up in Lakeview featuring a burger. We've talked a little bit about the show, too. We were just talking about the difficulties in the Bywater in general. We've talked about saturation to a degree. People come up with a good concept, barbecue maybe being one of the latest ones. And then there's a sort of a lemmings thing where people open up spots exactly like it in a similar neighborhood, or I shouldn't say exactly like it, but similar themes. And this is the type of stuff that I think can actually be a bit of a problem. We're talking about three burger joints in Lakeview. Here is the cautionary tale that we're talking about. Maybe we need to look a little bit into what this all means and how is that too much? One might argue that that's too much. So maybe something to think about there, but this is sort of the nature of the thing. Yes, I get competition. Probably one or two of these aren't going to make it, but that's sad. People lose their jobs. People invest a lot of money. Those of us who are customers invest really some interest and some heart into these places. Just saying. So something to think about. Friends, coming up on the show, as I mentioned in the next segment, we're going to talk a little bit about Tales of the Cocktail, a little bit of a retrospect, as I said. Later on, we're going to roll our first interview from Tales of the Cocktail, a gentleman named Toshi Ueno, who is from the Mutual Trading Incorporated, which is a company out of Southern California. They bring in sake and shochu and Japanese food products. And shochu is a distillate. We talk about that on the show, and we've talked about it before. So sake is a fermented rice wine. Shochu is a distillate, and it's actually can use rice, barley, sweet potato, and a couple other grains in there to make it. It's an interesting conversation. And we also then later on, so you'll get some education on that. There's a couple segments coming up with Toshi. And then what we are going to do, very pleased to have chatted with Michael Galata, who is the well-noted and award-winning chef and chef owner of both Mofo in Mid-City and Maypop, the pretty new spot there downtown on O'Keefe. And Michael's been getting a lot of accolades lately. He was named the 2016 Best New Chef by Food & Wine magazine, a whole bunch of other things. We actually don't even really get a whole lot into his accolades. It's a great, interesting story about his background, where he came from, how he got into cooking. He comes from a great legacy of having worked with Donald Link, John Besh, John Fulce, and others, spent time over in Italy and Germany, and then decided to open up a place that, you know, is based on largely Vietnamese cuisine and Southeast Asian cuisine. It's a really interesting conversation. He's a really cool guy. So I hope you stay tuned for that. And kind of an interesting concept that we talk about here that I want to get to is, you know, I asked him why Vietnamese? And he was saying, you know, sort of growing up when of his age bracket that, you know, most of what you got around here was quote unquote New Orleans food. And Vietnamese was the only legitimate moment at the time, ethnic food, basically well done and widely available. Certainly have more Honduran food here, and we've had fusion stuff, but the Honduran stuff came a little bit later, and you know, some of the stuff fusion is not really truly authentic, and he always really dug it because it was something different. And he said, you know, they feel a lot of people had gravitated that way, and that's really the motivation for this. And I think that's a really interesting conversation that we have with him. And then also with Toshi, I think what's kind of interesting, we talk about shochu. One of the questions that we talk about a little bit here too, almost in a different vein, get Vietnamese food because we have a big Vietnamese population. Shochu is a Japanese alcohol. And unlike, say, San Francisco springs to mind where I grew up by, we had a Japantown there. We had a big Japanese population all over, lots of great Japanese restaurants. Sake and shochu were always present because it was brought in there because the culture was there. And I asked, you know, what is the vector for shochu coming into the market here in New Orleans where we don't have a big Japanese population, well-established Japanese cuisine, these sorts of things. And the vector really is the craft cocktail market. So to me, I find that dynamic very interesting. We'll talk more about that in future shows, I think, is how some of these things come to be, how we start to get these things when we don't have that that enclave, that ethnic enclave or ethnic tradition in a particular location. I think Japanese stuff here in New Orleans serves as a really good example of this. So that's a fascinating conversation about shochu. We touched on that subject a little bit, but it's something I'd like to explore a little bit more here on the NOLA Drink Show. And then also after that, please be sure you stay tuned to the show and listen to our interview in the second hour with Michael Galata of both Mofo and Maypop. Friends, come on back.
Oregon wines are taking over New Orleans. The reason? They're delicious. Next time you're shopping for wine, grab a bottle of Sass Wine. Located in the South Salem Hills of Oregon's Willamette Valley, Sass Wine produces small amounts of handcrafted, high-quality wines that include Pinot Noir, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, and Rosé of Syrah. A perfect balance of full fruit with fine, supple tannins and firm acidity is what makes truly great wines, and you'll find that in every bottle of Sass Wine you drink.
Time for lunch? We've got you covered at Sobu.
Chef Juan Carlos whipped up special two-course lunches that start at $14.
Try our Creole Cuban sandwich and pair it with a bowl of our gumbo.
Of course, Sobu's full menu is also available.
And don't forget Sobu's version of Commander's Palace 25-cent martinis.
Available Monday through Friday, 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Join us at Sobu for our speedy lunch at 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Sobu, life is meant to be lived, not endured.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in the podcast land, wherever you are. Yes, friends, it was Tales of the Cocktail last week. It's an interesting event, as we know, most of us probably know or are familiar with it, at least in name. It's essentially the largest, maybe arguably the most important industry event for bartenders and spirits producers on the globe. Happens the third week of July every year here in New Orleans, and there's always a traveling road show that stays in the same place every 2 years and moves on internationally called Tales on Tour. We've talked a bit about Tales on the show. It's a complicated thing. It is a complicated thing, and there's been some controversy. I think we know that. We've touched on this on the show. And this is something, you know, we're going to continue to explore the dynamic of Tales of the Cocktail here in the coming weeks as we run these interviews. Because of what we have coming up on the show here today, don't have a lot of time to unpack a lot of this, and I still want to see some of the numbers and some of these things that have gone on. We are aware of the controversy that took place with founder Ann Tenderman and her husband, Paul, that they got in trouble with some racist remarks that were essentially made as they participated in Zulu. That was not the racist part. Okay, there have been some things that have come out of that, some efforts to be made to bridge some gaps. There's talk of a diversity council being established with TAILS. One of the things that I've said about TAILS in times past, I think that's a great idea, but I think sometimes TAILS might try and be too much to too many people and maybe should just focus on being a trade show and conference with some professional development. But some of the social issues, you know, professionals need to be brought in and these sorts of things. Again, don't want to unpack too much of that. We've talked about it before. For all of its difficulty, and then I guess one other dynamic too is that people start to ask some of these questions is, has it gotten too big for its own good? It is tough for small brands to come in and participate in Tales of the Cocktail. The fees that you pay to the organization, the fees that you pay if you want to do a special event that has to be sanctioned, you pay to Tales. And if you want to rent a venue, do buyouts, all of these things, it's really, really costly. So certain brands maybe are somewhat shut out. Now there's tasting room opportunities and things that are a little less expensive, but then sometimes you can maybe argue that what kind of attention do you get in a tasting room with a bunch of largely drunk people who are just coming in and drinking? Again, more issues to unpack later. It's gotten really big. There's those issues. The cost of these buyouts are astronomical. Some of these things that these people do are in the tens, if not, I mean, certainly hundreds of thousands of dollars when all's told to be able to rent out a large place, do a buyout. A good example is Johnny Walker for several days, 3-4 days, bought out a Stella restaurant, did a buyout, I should say, of the Stella restaurant there on Jackson Square. And they set up their own little cafe. They actually did painting on the glass doors to make it look like it was their place. I can't imagine what they actually paid to Stella, which does a good business year round because of its location on the square, and then, you know, rented the place, paid staff, did all this kind of stuff. I don't even want to venture a guess of what that cost. Then there were the events like Diageo, I believe, was put on at the Ace Hotel. They brought in Snoop Dogg, who apparently did, I think, like 5 songs. It was very difficult for people to get in because some of the organization of the event was not quite right with names on the guest lists and so on and so forth that RSVP'd. And for 5 songs, people saw like 10 or 15 minutes of the guy. Some of these late night events, big, big crowds, astronomical amount of money, these sorts of things. There are different things that people can be negative about, and that's fine, and we will touch on those. I'm not certainly not afraid here on the show to talk about these things, and I think that, you know, Tales of the Cocktail wants to get better. It's something that's gotten very big, maybe bigger than those who started it, and they need to realize that. But one of the things that's very important that I want to mention in reading some of the stuff afterwards, people from outside of New Orleans have talked about or maybe missed the mark on, is it's a big economic shot in the arm for the city at a time when we need it in the hospitality industry. So, you know, I think let's not look a gift horse in the mouth. Now, that is not to say let's not be critical of the event where criticism is due. Okay, we'd be very clear about that. But it does, a lot of our friends that work really hard throughout the year, this is a great way for a lot of our friends in the service industry. And as we note on this show quite often, the service industry is the backbone of the tourism economy, really, in New Orleans, which is the backbone of basically the economy in New Orleans. And this is a great way in what are the slow months of summer for people to make a good amount of money. And the restaurants desperately need it, the bars desperately need it, and these things. And again, some dynamics there with official Tales of the Cocktail events where people do buyouts and those that are just kind of being open and maybe using it to draft off of. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It's good for the economy of the city, and the city is good for Tales of the Cocktail. I will say that much. But overall, I think it was a really good event. It was nice to see that things were a little bit more spread out this year, meaning the place, the event basically takes place at the Hotel Monteleone on Royal. And then some of the stuff is also going on at the Royal Sonesta on Bourbon. So there's really that 2-3 block area where in years past, that was the center of the universe. From reports that I've gotten, anecdotal reports from friends in the industry, people were making it much further afield. Good crowds uptown, some okay crowds in mid-city, some of these places exploring new places, getting out, seeing new businesses, doing new things, which I think really helped spread some of the economic love, if you will, that went on with the event. So that's a really good thing. And I really want to highlight that, you know, that's a positive with the event. It brings a lot of people into town who are excited to be here. Yes, sometimes the behavior is a little questionable. I actually think one of the good things here is we get a lot of young bartenders who come into town and it becomes sort of a cocktail hero thing. You know, we like to use that term here on the show, and it kind of almost like a frat party. But then you have true professionals that are here. And I think maybe there's some learned behavior that you actually learn that this is a professional trade conference, and hopefully people come away learning how they should behave by some of the elders, if you will, in the industry. And I think it's a great time for people who maybe aren't exposed to some of the luminaries in the industry, some of the veterans in the industry, to some of those that are true teachers in the industry, to see how they behave, see what it is they do, to garner knowledge from these people. And I think that that's a significant positive of Tales of the Cocktail as well, is that it does allow people to rub elbows with people that they need to in that industry, in the bartending industry, in the spirits industry, and these things. It still does, in many ways, provide good opportunities for new brands to showcase. We got to talk to a few of those people out there during the show. You'll hear some of those interviews coming up, as well as established brands being able to connect with people. So that's another, I think, really important thing here to note, that, you know, overall, this is a positive event for the city. And sure, we need to keep on keeping on when it comes to talking about how it can be better. And I think we need to understand the local perspective behind it. Good for the economy, hard. Everybody works really, really hard. What it means to the fabric of the city, what some of the difficulties with Tales of Cocktail have meant to both the industry broader, what they try and represent, as well as actually what it means to New Orleans. And we'll continue to unpack that. But a lot of really fun stuff that went on. One of the highlights, I mean, there's a bunch of highlights that we'll talk about, but one of the things that I wanted to mention was really cool. Met a bunch of bartenders from Montreal, and they all got together. They noticed that Montreal didn't really have a signature cocktail, kind of like we do here in New Orleans. Of course, the Sazerac, the official cocktail, of New Orleans, the only city in the United States to have an official cocktail, I would add, if you don't know that. And they got together and they decided, hey, Montreal needs an official cocktail. And they called it, go figure, the Montreal cocktail. And what they basically did is they all got together and put it together. The basic recipe is 3/4 ounce Sipsmith London Dry Gin, 3/4 ounce Canadian Club Rye, of course, it's Canadian, Montreal, 3/4 ounce Galliano, and 3/4 ounce Suze. So kind of a nod to some of the culture, Canadian Club there, of course, Canadian Rye, Suze, mentioned, you know, referencing it's a French liqueur, Gentian, referencing the French culture, of course, the London Dry Gin, the Sipsmith, referencing the British part of the Canadian culture, and it's equal parts of those three. And it was really interesting. It's a cool drink. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very tasty. All the bartenders were basically serving that recipe, and a very nice gal whose name eludes me was kind of guiding me through this. But like what we talked about, for example, is you swapped in, say, Aperol for the Galliano Aperitivo, it changed the nature of the drink. You can imagine if you change the Suze, the Gentian liqueur, maybe you use Sailors or something like that, will change the character of the drink. And of course, gin being the major distillate in that, there is going to change whatever gin choice you make, is going to change the drink. So that was something that they encouraged, that you basically play with the drink a little bit, and I think that's pretty cool. You stir all the ingredients with ice and strain it into a chilled glass, and add grapefruit zest. Grapefruit. I'm having a hard time talking. I'm recovered from Tales of the Cocktail. Add grapefruit zest and enjoy there. And a little grapefruit peel goes a long way in that drink. That was a really neat thing. One other thing before we take a quick break here, really fun to see. And I got a whole bunch of highlights that I'm not going to get to in the show, but we'll come back to those down the road. Happened to be walking by, I believe it was on Bienville, saw a little pop-up place. Not even sure who put it on. It was called Le Café de Nuit. And it definitely was a coffee martini using Grey Goose. So I'm assuming they had some involvement, one of these little buyout or pop-ups, rental of the place. But what they had going on, they were serving the drink, and this was the middle of the afternoon, having a big party, a lot of British people around, really a lot of fun. And they had a little live stream. The bartenders were from a bar called Swift in downtown London, and they had a Facebook live stream that was going back, shared between the bar in London and then here in New Orleans. And there was a lot of yelling and a lot of cheering. I just thought that was a really cool idea. So we had drinks with our friends all the way over there in London during Tales of the Cocktail. Friends, we're going to be back with our interview with Toshi Ueno of Mutual Trading Incorporated talking about shochu, and then stay tuned right after that. We're going to be back with Michael Galata of Maypop and Mofo. Friends, come on back.
The French Market offers daily entertainment and delicious food and drink options throughout our 6-block district. Whether you crave raw oysters or fresh produce, authentic confections or healthy daiquiris, you can find it here. Sit at one of our cafes and hear live local music. Enjoy a muffaletta, po' boy, salad, or cheese plate in the farmer's market. Check out our pop-up farmer's markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays for even more fresh food options. History is being made fresh daily at the French Market. Visit frenchmarket.org for food, drink, retail, and event listings.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In 2008, the Louisiana legislature made the Sazerac cocktail the official cocktail of New Orleans, affirming what New Orleanians had known for over 150 years. You just can't beat a good Sazerac. The Sazerac cocktail is the quintessential New Orleans drink, perfect for celebrating the arrival of fall festivals, football season, or just being proud to be a New Orleanian. For the official recipe, visit www.sazerac.com.
This is Christopher Icaza, General Manager of Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street in the beautiful Vaucaray. We encourage you to come join us this fall and experience the renovation of one of the French Quarter's Grand Dames. Join us in our beautifully renovated Napoleon Dining Room. Come see our friend Paul Gustings at the beautiful Empire Bar. Experience one of the French Quarter's loveliest courtyards. That's Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street. Open 7 nights a week and every Sunday for brunch.
Hello, this is Ron Bartholomew, and to my great city of New Orleans, I'd like to introduce to you Touch Vodka. This artisan handcrafted ultra-premium vodka is uniquely distilled from Florida's finest wildflower honey and American grain. Touch also produces key lime, Valencia orange, and ruby red grapefruit selections that are infused with natural oils of locally sourced fruit, which results in a unique 80-proof vodka with no sugar added or coloring. Touch is now available at Doranax, Cello's, and the Corporation Grill and Bar, and many other locations across Louisiana. This holiday season, sit back and relax and enjoy Touch Vodka.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. If you're listening to this show, you love good food and good wine. And a great wine with our plentiful fresh Gulf seafood is the Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc, a crisp, balanced white blend from the south of France. Whether it's with fresh oysters, crab, redfish, or shrimp, this Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc will not disappoint. And it's a great value at around $14. Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc. Cheers!
Goodbye, Joe. I gotta go, me old Mayo. I gotta go, pull a hero.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in the podcast world, wherever you may be. Thanks for tuning in today. Yes, Tales of the Cocktail 2017. Here we are, technically day four. You're hearing this sometime after. And we are back at Sylvain, our good friend's restaurant here in the French Quarter, taping for the show. And I'm pleased to be joined by my next guest, Toshio Ueno.
Yep.
From Mutual Trading Company, or Mutual Trading Incorporated, is that correct?
Yes, it is. Okay. Located in Los Angeles, California, is a headquarter. We have office in New York, Hawaii, Arizona, Vegas, Texas, Boston, and Washington, D.C.
Okay, great. And so you guys are an importation company?
Yes, we are an importer of Japanese food and also Japanese alcohol beverage, too.
Oh, yes. You do food as well. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We have about 3,000 food items. So if you want to open up a Japanese restaurant, we have everything from non-food to food to sake to shochu to Japanese wine.
Okay, great. And that's what we're talking about today. And thanks for being here, Toshio.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So we're talking about shochu today, which is a category. It's growing, correct, at least in the United States.
A little by little. That's what we are trying to do.
A little by little, right? And are you starting to find that, are you getting more success with shochu, with bartenders, that sort of thing?
Well, you know, at this moment, most of the shochus are consumed by more likely Japanese people, not so many American people. So we are here to introduce and promote shochu to American mainstream people. We are trying, baby, step by step, you know, right. And it's not yet. But, you know, some of the like metropolitan area like L.A. and New York bartenders start using shochu as a cocktail ingredient.
Now, and it's, you raised a couple interesting points there, Toshio, because one of the things, as I mentioned to you before we went on the air, I grew up near San Francisco, so very big Japanese population, Japanese-American population. Here in New Orleans, we don't have that big of a Japanese population. So things like shochu, Japanese food, sake, you know, the culture is very present in that part of the world, whereas we have less of it here, as I said. Does that present an interesting challenge then?
It is a big challenge, and I don't think it's so easy. We were thinking about more than 10 years or more than 20 years to, you know, get to the point as mezcal or tequila popularity. We are not there yet. You know, we are still Japanese, unknown, single distillation spirit. But it's unique. It's very unique because, you know, most of the spirits are distilled a few times.
Right.
The shochu is only distilled only one time by pot still. So you still have the congener or the original characteristic of ingredients as a flavor. So as we taste later, you can taste, let's say, sweet potato we're going to be tasting right. later. You can taste and smell the baked sweet potato.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you just said that I want to make sure people understand is maybe you're familiar with sake. Shochu is a distillate. It is not fermented wine. Okay. We don't stop there.
Make it clear.
Yep.
So if you distill wine, you become brandy. If you distill sake, it becomes shochu.
Right.
Right.
Perfect. There's a good
and
example.
And if you distill beer, it becomes whiskey.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's a great way to put it. So yeah. Because I think sometimes people are confused, and I've seen sometimes people, they take a first sip of shochu, and they weren't quite ready for what they were tasting. A little higher in alcohol than maybe what they thought they were going to get.
Yeah. The sake is usually 14 to 16% alcohol by content, but shochu is 25, so it's pretty high. But comparing to other spirits, it's low,
right?
More palatable,
right? And so it is something that can very easily. I mean, I've had it in a few cocktails, but I just generally prefer to taste it neat.
So it's kind of a part of the challenge too, because with that, you know, if you're gonna make it a cocktail, alcohol level for shochu is a little bit lower than usual. So that's a challenge for bartender to make the good taste cocktail, not losing that original character of the shochu itself.
Right. Now, there does seem to be a little bit of a trend these days, too, where lower alcohol, lower ABV cocktails are becoming more fashionable.
Yeah, that's why we are on the trend now. But still, though, it's very not like, you know, regular vodka or tequila, much, much higher alcohol contents, and you can mixed with any kind of juice and still has that tequila taste and stuff. So.
Yeah, right. So let's tell people, Toshio, where is, in general, what part of the country is shochu made?
Well, shochu is made in the southern part of Japan, Kyushu Island mainly, which is the southern tip of Japanese island. We have 6,800 few islands, but there's only four big islands, Hokkaido in the north and main island, the Honshu regions, and Kyushu is the southern tip of the island. All this shochu, main authentic shochu is from there, yeah.
And so, as you mentioned, let's talk a little bit about production. So only distilled once. And there are, now, by definition, there are three or four base agricultural products that can be used. Is that right, or
well,
is there more?
In the regulation, you can use much more than that,
okay.
40 few. But, you know, main one is barley, sweet potato, rice, Thai rice, sugar cane, and buckwheat. Those are main ones.
Okay.
But the major one is sweet potato and barley and rice. Those are three major ones.
So you'll get a great deal of diversity, correct? Where
yes.
Some will only be one of those and some will be blends of combinations
right.
of those, correct?
And it's by region too. You know, like Kagoshima in the southern tip of the Kyushu Island is more sweet potato. If you go to north, it's more barley. And then if you go to west side of the Kyushu Island, it's rice. Base. So
okay.
By region, they have, you know, special local regional crop.
Yes.
Yeah, on grains.
So a lot of the grains are then, it's a very local product. Yes. Then in many ways. Yes. Right? The produce is what you're getting. Yeah. Locally and. Yeah. The distillery's. Mm-hmm. There and using. Mm-hmm. What's there.
Right.
Now, is it something that as far as we know, there are actually lots of different varieties of sweet potato and obviously lots of different varieties of rice. Is it pretty common where there's a variation of varietals used with, say, within the rice category?
Rice is not so much, but sweet potato, you have so many different kinds. So one sweet potato is a little bit sweeter, and the other one has a much, much more flavor and complex and more earthy. And so you can have so many different types, because even though it's a single distillation, there is a atmospheric distillation and also. Okay. Vacuum distillation. You know, alcohol boiling point is 89.3.
Right.
That's atmospheric boiling point.
Right.
But if you vacuum under the pressure, the temperature goes lower, a boiling point.
Right.
So that means you don't damage the mash so much. You don't have to burn. You don't burn the mash so much. So. Okay. You get more cleaner, clear taste.
Okay.
So, you know, mixing components or, you know. Mm-hmm. The different types of stuff when blending it, you have so many different types of the, even though it's one sweet potato, has different types.
Right. Interesting. I had never learned that part before. That's really fascinating. So tell us a little bit, Toshio, about shochu. It's been made for a very long time in Japan, correct?
It's interesting because, you know, distilling method was created in East Asia, right?
Right.
Yep. And they, one went to West to Scotland.
Right.
And
right.
One went to Japan through the Silk Road. And it's been, it was there 16th century. So it's the same time as Scotch.
Right.
So it's been about 500 to 600 years.
And it's long ago enough, it's somewhat unclear, right, the exact origin, because it's been done for so long. Is that true? As far as, well, when it originally was called shochu, when it was first made, by who first made it,
we don't know. It's coming from China, Laos, or it's coming from Thailand. But as you can see, one of the shochu from Okinawa region, which is very south island, has the most southern island in Japan, called shochu, called Awamori. And the Aomori has to be made with Thai rice.
Okay.
That's the evidence. We think that this shochu is coming from Thailand, not from China.
Okay.
Thailand, and the research found out that one of the pot stills they use in Thailand is the same as the one, old one, traditional one used in Aomori. So there's the evidence that the record saying probably coming from Thailand.
Very interesting.
But this is a interesting part, because land transportation takes much longer time. Back in, we didn't have trains and highways, and so it was, you know, much faster to use a ship to transport items. So it's more possible coming from Thailand to Japan than going through the Silk Road and coming over.
And all the way over.
And it's much safer too for, you know, commodities to be on the ship than on the ground.
Right. That
it's
makes
much
sense.
Harder, yeah.
And we know that people bring this with them, right? So if it was a trading that went on perhaps with Thailand, or even people that came from there that emigrated from there and brought their own method, right?
Exactly. So Okinawan people, doesn't look like me.
Okay.
More like Polynesian face.
Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm like more like, looks like Chinese, Korean, Japanese face, Mongolian face. But for the Okinawan people, looks like Filipinos and
Southeast
Asian. Yeah.
Well, Toshio, let's do this. We're going to take a quick break here on the show, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to talk a little bit more about shochu, taste a couple of the nice bottles that you brought. So, friends, hey, come on back to the Nola Drink Show.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region. Producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Hey, ladies. Are you looking for wine to bring to your next girls' night out?
Grab a bottle of Capitello wines and enjoy the taste of fruit from Oregon's Willamette Valley. Capitello has a wide variety of wines to choose from. Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, dessert wine, and a Brut Sparkling that's a blend of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. He'll even stop by next time he's in town. So grab the girls, have fun, and enjoy Capitello wine. Cheers.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
Get in the groove and let the good times roll. We're gonna stay here till it's through our soul.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Noel Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning into the show today. We are chatting with Toshio Ueno, who is from Mutual Trading Incorporated, an importer that brings in all kinds of Japanese products, but we're talking about shochu today. And when we just took a little break, Toshio, you were just telling us about the health benefits of drinking shochu. So this is another good point. Let's bring this up.
Yeah, like, you know, I'm 53 years old, getting old, you know. I have high cholesterol and I have pressure, but there is a special enzyme called urokinase, which is an enzyme will melt down your blood clot in your veins. So if you have a high cholesterol or high blood pressure, I will recommend you to drink shochu instead of other drinks.
I'm going to take that medical advice.
And, you know, that it's been proven by a doctor in Japan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's another thing that I've learned. See, so drink more shochu.
Yes, drink right, more shochu, yeah.
It's good for everybody.
Yeah,
so we were talking a little bit about some of the different grains that you can use where in Japan that it was grown, a bit about the history. It is a very, you're talking about different production methods and then different grains, different blends. Another thing that we want people to understand, I think, is how diverse the flavor profiles are from one producer to another, one bottle to another. It's a very diverse category.
It is. So let's talk about, you know, one ingredient like rice. Even though rice, if you do atmospheric traditional way of making it, you have a more complexity, more grain, nuttier, and some vegetable like mushrooms and more complex, more body. But if you do in vacuum distillation, you get fruity, floral, and texture is much lighter, and the body is lighter, and much cleaner.
Right.
So, you know, that itself makes it different types. And then you have different making of the mash, you know, what kind of mash mash fermentation can be, you know, different temperature. So by the maker, even in one maker can make different types of rice shochu.
And many, so we have a situation where same set of ingredients, but the process then is...
Yeah, there's one maker here today at the TOC. One maker is making fruity light one with vacuum and traditional type of more complex and deep flavor ones. And then she has one more with aged one.
Okay.
Aging oak, so it has more vanillas and, you know, more...
Browner, darker notes. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, let's taste the first one here.
Okay. So we're tasting barley.
Thank you.
And this is from a Takara company called Yokaichi Shochu. So it's made from barley. So you have a little bit of toasty barley aroma, and then on the palate it's much more lighter and fruitier and more acidic too.
Yeah, so you just said, sorry, we kind of lost sound there for a second, so a little bit fruitier, a little bit more acidic. It's very, very clean.
Yeah,
right.
On the nose, you know, it's more toasty, but on the palate it's more cleaner and more fruitier.
Now, Toshio, are a lot of the producers of shochu, is this still very a family-oriented type business? A lot of families own the distilleries?
Yeah, it is indeed.
And you're must be a challenge to work with sometimes.
Most of them are family-owned. And one company, I don't want to say which company because they might be listening to this, but, you know, they have, you know, family number one, family number two, family number three, and, you know, and this is that he's from number one family, number two family, and they're in all in the company.
Okay.
It's sometimes it complicate things.
It can be complicated. We'll leave it at that. It's all family run. There's good parts that come with the family run stuff, and then there's bad parts that come with the family run stuff.
Yeah.
Great. Well, I find this one very, very nice. I do get some nice floral notes. I almost get a banana note on this. Yeah. Which is very good, very enjoyable. Well, what about the next one?
Next one is sweet potato.
Okay. Is that this one?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
And this one is 100% sweet potato. When you make a sweet potato, the first mash is usually rice. But this one is, the first mash is also sweet potato. So 100% sweet potato shochu. So you can smell baked sweet potato, caramelized sugar, caramelized sweet potato, and some of that fruity note, like dry apricot.
Yep.
And
there's sort of an earthier note to this one as well. Yeah, I really like that. And
the sweetness, too.
And definitely, especially on the finish, the sweetness hangs
through
a little bit. It's and again, this is to our point, too. The level of diversity within the shochu world is a point that I still want to make sure that we're very, very clear on. These two things obviously share some similarities, but they are very, very, very different.
Yep. People say, you know, shochu and soju or whatever, they think it's the same thing. It's totally different. Ingredients are different. And I just want to make one thing clear. Korean soju and Japanese shochu is a little bit different.
Yes.
A big difference. I mean, actually big.
Yeah.
Because Korean soju is multiple distillation. And Japanese shochu, honkaku shochu, authentic shochu is single distillation. So there we are more trying to keep the congener, original flavor characteristic of ingredient. They're trying to try to take that off.
Okay.
And make it more cleaner taste.
Okay. Yeah, and so often, too, I noticed in times past when I lived in Korea with soju, what was so popular were the flavored sojus. Very sweet.
Most of them are flavored with sweetener and also some amino acid is in it, so it's more palatable. But we don't in Japan, we don't add anything. It's just a straight distillate.
Great. So we have about a minute and a half left here, Toshio. As far as the category of shochu, we talked a little bit at the beginning about this. Are we seeing more growth? Are you positive where the category is going?
Yes. The reason why is this flavor. Even though this is a distilled spirit, I think this is more similar to wine because you have the flavor of ingredients more than any other spirits. And it's amazing how much let's say this sweet potato still remains in the liquid. And it's a similar one, it would be tequila. You know, tequila, even though it's a distill, you can taste the agave still.
You can taste the agave.
This one's the same thing. And, if you, I don't want to put down other spirits, but this is different.
It's a terroir, and we talk about this with certain categories of spirits, like you said, with agave, so tequila, mezcal, pisco. Being another good example, the terroir is a huge component of this.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes people also miss the mark where they think, oh, well, you know, a liquor is a liquor, like a hard liquor is a hard liquor, and it doesn't really matter where the ingredients come from and these sorts of things. I can still make it taste the same. And in this category, it's very terroir driven.
I know. And also, you know, shochu, you have to use koji. Koji is a Japanese microbe or fungi. And otherwise,
also used in sake, right?
Also used in sake. Sake koji is yellow koji, but for shochu, is used black koji and white koji, which produce more acidic mash.
Okay.
So you can protect the mash from the bacterial infection. So that's the reason why it's southern regions. It's much warmer, humid.
Right.
But it can survive.
Right, okay. That's a really key component of making sake and shochu is koji.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, really quickly, where can people find information online about what you guys have?
www.lamtc.com or my sake school. I also run sake school of America. So you go www.sakeschoolofamerica.com.
Okay, great. And we'll have you on again, Toshi. And let's talk about sake next time.
Yeah. Okay, we should great. Next time.
Thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Friends, we were just chatting with Toshi Ueno from Mutual Trading Incorporated. We're talking about shochu, a very interesting category. Go try some yourself for sure. Absolutely. Hey, come on back to the Noel Drink Show.
Tim McNally, welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirits Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drinks Show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in the podcast land, wherever you're listening to the show. I always appreciate you tuning in. Yes, as you know, we're talking a lot about Tales of the Cocktail this week and our survival thereof, but a little reprieve from Tales of the Cocktail nicely is we are here taping at Maypop, and we are chatting with Chef Michael Galata. Michael, how are you, man?
I'm doing great.
Absolutely, man. Thanks for being here and taking a little time out to talk to us today.
Not a problem. I'm always here anyway.
Yeah, you're always here. It works out convenient. I knew where to find you.
Yeah.
So since we were just talking about it, how did Tales of the Cocktail work out for you this year?
We had a really good Tales. In fact, I mean, it's just, you know, what Anne's built over the years now. At first, we were like, what is this? And now it has become such a thing, such an amazing thing. You know, it helps everyone in the city during that time. You know, who knew, you know, when it started, what, a decade ago?
This was the 15th, I believe.
15th?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And, starting out is essentially...
Yeah, that would make sense, because I was doing spirited dinners back when I first started in August.
Okay, you know? Yeah, absolutely.
So that would make perfect sense, yeah.
And I think, you know, sort of coming out of the gate as a pub crawl, almost.
Right.
You know, and then now what it's turned into of 20, 25,000 people attending every year. And
We did two 200-person parties, you know, one for Bombay Sapphire and one for Casanova Tequila. And it was just, the turnout was insane.
That's great. I heard really good things about the Casa Noble event.
Thank God for that.
Yeah. Good. Right on. Right on. I think, I don't know how you feel about it. It's sort of one of the, it kind of reminds me of Mardi Gras around here when Tales of Cocktail, it's like the thing, it's fun while it's going on. By the time it's over, it's like, I'm glad it's over.
Yeah. I had to spend a day out in the garden at MoFo just to sort of recenter myself.
Right. Exactly. Well, cool. We want to chat with you a little bit here and get a little bit first time on the show, which I, again, appreciate a little bit about your background and what you do and all that kind of stuff and how you got started. We'll talk, of course, about MoFo, which was your...
Yeah.
Was that your first spot, Michael?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So that was a surprise. MoFo was a surprise. So, I mean, I from New Orleans... You know, went to Nicholls State University down in Thibodaux, Louisiana, culinary school.
Yep.
Worked for John Fulce. Got to work for Pete Vasquez way back in the day at Marisol. He beat me up for a while. And then an amazing chef to work for. You know, everything was made in-house, and that was the first time I'd ever experienced that. But then I got the job with Vesh and started as a line cook. But at the same time that I got the job with Vesh, I just got green-lighted to go do a stage in Italy. And I, you know, the day I got hired, I told him that. I'm like, hey, man, I'm going to Italy.
Can't turn that down,
and,
right?
And he was like, that's the kind of cooks I'm looking for. You know, I'm looking for people who are trying to find more. And I was like, okay, cool. So I worked for him for 6 months and then left and went to Italy and hung out there for 8 months. They didn't pay me, so I eventually ran out of money. Came back.
Come back.
Came back to the States. And then the first thing he asked is like, man, how was Italy? And I'm like, I need to get back to Europe. Like, I need to get back. And he's like, well, cool, give me a year. And then I'll send you to my old boss in Germany. So I gave him a year as a tournant, so basically working every station.
Yeah.
And then went to Germany and just fell in love, ended up staying a year and a half just because I was having so much fun. You know,
where in Germany were you?
The Black Forest.
Oh yeah.
So southern Black Forest, they call it the Hochschwarzwald, or the high Black Forest. They seem to think that they are the greatest of the Germans, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I think in many parts of Germany you might get that same sentiment, right?
But they're actually really, really sweet people, and like in this little town, so no one spoke English, so I had to learn German, which was pretty cool. And we only served what the chef hunted, so that was amazing.
That's
so it was
cool.
All wild boar and elk and wild deer, because he would travel all over and hunt with all of his friends, all of his chef friends, and he'd been a chef for so long, his family was like six generations back owning the hotel.
Wow.
So like he knew politicians everywhere, so he was like going to hunt in these pristine places up north and bringing back these giant elk and things. I mean, it was insane.
So these guys are going out collectively as chefs and hunting, and then everybody splitting it up for their spots?
I'm not sure what everyone else was doing, but he would take a lot of the meat because he was known for serving the wild game. So he would bring it all back. And we had, like, the hotel had been in his family for so long. He had built a butcher shop and a cheese making shop. And he actually he actually bored into the side of the mountain that the hotel sat on, and built all these. Like we had a hanging room for all the meat. It was amazing.
Now I'm assuming that you had some experience dealing with that with Foles, right? To a degree, as far as doing.
No, I mean, I was just a line cook for him.
Okay,
I was the grand manger at Lafitte's Landing. At Bittersweet Plantation when he moved Lafitte's.
Yeah.
So okay. I was the grand manger cook. So I didn't, you know, at that point you're so green. You're just trying to make it
and keep your head
above
water.
You're not really learning at that point. You're just trying to keep your head above water.
right, not get fired.
So by the time I got to Germany, I'd already lived in Italy. I'd already been torn on for Besh. So I kind of, you get to that point where you know enough to start learning, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like you know enough to where you can look at things and be like, okay, I can build on what I already know. You know, now I can butcher down an entire boar. Now I can butcher down an entire. And the cool thing was, he also had farmer friends who would bring us whole calves. Butchering a calf is way more intense than butchering a boar.
Yeah,
just because they're so big, you can get lost.
Right.
Like you get halfway through and you're like, I don't know where I'm going in this thing. You know, a boar is small enough, even a 300-pound boar is small enough to where you can kind of find your way around. But when you get a whole quarter of a calf, it's a little bit different.
No, and where to make the cuts. I mean, I've seen that done here and there in my life, and that's definitely a different challenge.
Unless you've done it for a long time, then it's easy. But for me, I was still pretty green in butchering at that point. So that was really cool to see those big, big animals. And, I mean, he had the whole setup with a winch and everything. And, like, some of these animals were so big, you'd winch them all up to the ceiling, and their ass would still be on the ground. So you'd like, one cook would have to hold the feet while the other one was skinning them, and it was pretty intense.
That's amazing. That's an amazing experience.
So I was there when Katrina hit.
Okay.
So I got to watch my neighborhood get washed away on German CNN, which is pretty cool.
Great.
So I'm like, okay, I better go home. It was really, because I mean, I'm literally in this beautiful, lush valley in the southern Black Forest of Germany. So you look outside and you see nothing but these beautiful rolling hills, and you look on the TV and you're like, oh, I got to go home.
this is not good.
Yeah, it's not good at all. Der Spiegel, the magazine Der Spiegel.
Sure.
I still have the cover photo of New Orleans underwater on Der Spiegel, which is pretty cool. And so I didn't get back into the city until November.
Okay.
So right before Thanksgiving.
Right.
I got into the city and I wasn't going to come back. I wasn't going to come back right away. I was like, John, I called John up and I'm like, hey, can I even get back into the city? And he's like, hell yeah, we're here feeding people. So, you know, because I was going to go, I was like, I can go work for one of your friends in New York until you're ready for me or yada, yada, yada. I didn't know what was going on. All I was hearing was that the airports were shut down, used only for medical, you know, this and that. You can't get into the city,
right.
You know. So either I was going to fly into an airport near there and try to drive in, find someone to come get me. I don't know. And he's like, no. As soon as the airports reopen to regular traffic, get in here and we'll start cooking. Or we're already cooking. Why aren't you here yet?
Had you given up your residence here to move to Germany, or did you actually have a place?
I never really had a residence.
Okay.
So that was kind of the cool thing about, I had enough. When you're a young line cook and you're trying to work in good restaurants, better not to ever sign leases anywhere, because you're typically working for about $6 to $7 an hour, at least back in early 2000 you were.
Right.
You know, when I started in August, I was getting paid $7 an hour. So you really can't. So I literally lived with friends of mine who had better paying jobs.
Roommate wanted type stuff.
Yeah. So I'd rent out a room, or I'd rent out a couch or something like that. Like they'd be like, here, give me a couple of bucks and you can crash here for, and that's literally what I did. I lucked out that I happened to have friends who had real jobs, and so I could crash with them and still be able to, you know, and still be able to get up and leave if I ever wanted to.
Right.
You know, the early journeyman phase of cooking is kind of a, you are just that. You are a journeyman. You're picking up and moving to the next spot whenever you can to learn more. So if you're tied down anywhere, it really kind of hurts your ability, because it is a craftsman. It's
a
craft.
It's a craft. Yeah,
so
absolutely.
You have to be able to move around and learn from different people
as opportunities present themselves.
So
like you've
I didn't
done.
Have anything. You know, what I did have was either in storage at my mom's, or still just the room that I grew up in at my mom's house.
Which is where?
Lakeview.
Oh, you grew up in Lakeview. Okay.
Yeah, so I grew up not far from Mount Carmel,
yep.
That kind of area.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so, of course, that all got wiped away. 16 feet of water and all that fun stuff.
Yeah.
So,
well, Michael, can we do me one favor, man? Yep. Can we take a little pause here? We got to take a little break,
cool.
And then we're going to come back and continue the conversation.
Love it.
Appreciate it. Friends, we're chatting with Chef Michael Galata from Maypop and Mofo and other places, getting his backstory here on the NOLA Drink Show. We're going to chat with him a little bit more. Come on back.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Bageau heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
Looking for a bottle of wine to impress your friends and family? Miro Cellars from California's Russian River Valley is the perfect wine for any occasion. Miro Cellars searches the region for the finest grapes to make their one-of-a-kind specialty wines. Award-winning winemaker Miro Chelikov considers the particular geology and seasonal climate of each vineyard when selecting the most interesting grapes the region has to offer. Because Miro has complete freedom to make precisely the wines he loves best, the results are spectacular. Let yourself in on one of the best-kept secrets in wine today, Miro Cellars.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event, or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
Mighty cootie fire on a mighty broad day.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in today. It's a pleasure. We're chatting with Chef Michael Galata of Maypop and Mofo. I'm going to kind of start combining those two
at some point,
Michael. Okay.
No worries.
Cool. And we're getting, you know, we're talking to you a little bit about your background and your history here in New Orleans. And just here during the break, you were telling me that you have a strong history in bicycles.
Yes. Oddly enough, both sides of my family have been in New Orleans a long time, because my mom's a Valette, which is
okay.
Like 1760s New Orleans. They were shipbuilders in Old Algiers. That's why there's a Valette Street in Old Algiers.
Yeah.
So they all had dry docks on the West Bank. And then my dad's side were all Sicilian immigrants, but they had Gus B. Tatton's on bicycles on Broad, and then which then grew into, there was one on when it closed in the 80s, there was one on Broad, there was one on Causeway. And then there was a giant wholesale, which ended up becoming, we used to call it the Half Depot on Carrollton.
Okay.
Yeah. So there was a giant wholesale bicycle plate. And basically, it's funny, my mom always tells the story. My dad was such a psycho about his business that when they went on their honeymoon, he used the honeymoon to go and meet small production bicycle guys in Italy. So he traveled around Italy on their honeymoon and worked the whole time meeting all these small production guys. So basically in the 80s, if you wanted a small production handmade Italian bike, I mean, the bicycle store had been around since his great uncle had opened it.
That's amazing. And you said it was the longest continuous run bicycle store.
It was opened in 1880s and then it closed in the 1980s. So it was open when it closed. It was the oldest continual operating bicycle store in America when it closed.
In America, wow, yeah.
But so my dad inherited it, and he and his t- technically he and his dad still ran it, but he was the one really pushing it to grow. And so, yeah, so we went to Italy, and my mom's like, oh, we're going on our honeymoon. And the whole time, she's like, wait a second, I didn't realize you were going to work the whole time. And so he made all these friendships, and so started bringing in all these really amazing handmade Raleighs and Chinellis and Campagnolos. And so if you wanted to get one of those handmade bikes, you had to get it through him. And so he just, you know, the business was taking off at that time. And he even started making there. Actually, there's a few. My brother and I found them on the internet. There's a few handmade BTAT bikes that he and his friends started making. They started hand making bikes, and there was less than 100 made. But you know, they've had this big resurgence of like hard to find handmade bikes, and they're now like a collector's item.
Yeah, what was the film Breaking Away?
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Right,
yeah, in the late 70s. I know Breaking Away. Yeah.
Okay. Sure.
I know that one. I know
Me
Breaking
too.
Away.
I'm that old, so
we all watch that. Uh-huh. So yeah, it's amazing. And then of course, you know, when the 80s hit, and then they started selling bicycles at Walmart and at Kmart, they started selling bicycles. And so the mass produced bicycle came around, and BTAT just didn't make it. No, plus my dad passed away, so right. No one really to oversee the company, and it just sort of fell apart. Unfortunately,
and tried. That's too bad.
So
now, what's your mom's relationship with bicycles these days? Is she still okay with bicycles after that?
it's funny because you know what she still has, because she helped run the business when he first passed. So she knows a ton, but I mean, obviously, we're all out of practice with that.
Right, fair enough. Well, Michael, what prompted you then? Given your, did you have a culinary tradition in your family, or was it just sort of?
Well, I mean,
the family liked to cook.
I just started watching cooking shows.
Okay,
and I got really into it. Obviously, oddly enough, my mom's grandmother was a really intense cook, but she was Irish. But she cooked some of the best Italian food. She made the most amazing bruschettoni. She made the most amazing griots and grits. And, you know, her nickname was the Battle Axe. She was a rough lady.
All right, gotcha. But, that's descriptive. I don't think we need to go any further down that road.
She was the grandparent that you don't appreciate till later in life.
Gotcha.
You know, like my Italian grandmother was the one we all liked, because she got us toys and brought us to the trampoline place and the fun arcade. Whereas my Irish grandmother gave us socks and underwear and the things that we didn't appreciate as children.
Mm-hmm.
But she was the one that was always there to take us if my mom had something to do. And so she was the strict one. But she always cooked for us. There's a really funny story where we told my grandmother that we liked my dad's mom's waffles. We're like, oh, we love Mama Galata's waffles.
This is not going to go well, is it?
And so Doris, who was my mom's mom, goes to Edith, who was my dad's mom, and she's like, I heard you have a really great waffle recipe, because my, you know, my mom's mom cooks everything from scratch, and my dad's mom didn't cook. And goes to her, and she's like, I heard you have this really great waffle recipe. The boys love it. I always just make them pancakes. And she's like, oh, no, those are Eggos. I just. She's like, they just love them because I drop them twice in the toaster so they get really crunchy.
That's great.
Yeah. She was not amused.
Not amused, right.
So my mom's mom, Doris, always cooked. And then my mom remarried a fire chief. And in the culture in South Louisiana, if you're a fire chief in New Orleans, you have to know how to cook, because all the guys cook for each other in the firehouses.
Absolutely.
And not only do they cook for each other, they cook for like 30 grown men who eat like horses.
Yep.
So my, and of course, all of them are typically fishermen or shrimpers on their off time. Or basically the fireman is their off time, and then their real job is they're a shrimperman or they're a fisherman.
Right.
So my stepdad was always out on shrimp boats. And he would go work on his friend's boats and get paid in shrimp. And so we'd always have ice chests full of shrimp, or freezers full of Ziploc bags of shrimp and water. You know, the whole, he'd bring them home, we'd pop all the heads, they'd go into a Ziploc bag with water to protect them, and then they'd all go into the freezers.
Right.
That's why our you know, when Katrina hit, our garage was not a cool place to be. It was nothing but rotten shrimp.
Oh, man. Okay.
But he was always just crazy about cooking. So we were always testing recipes, and, you know, because he wanted to show off at the firehouse. So we were always cooking all the time at my house. And so I guess that probably had something to do with it. And then I started getting into cooking shows. And so then it kind of became this hybrid. I would see things. I would bring the ideas to my mom and my stepdad. And then they would bring me to the store, and they'd buy everything for me. And then I'd cook dinner for them.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So that's great experience. How
that was
old
probably,
were you roughly at this time?
Anywhere between 9 and 13.
Oh, okay. So you developed a passion for it early and an interest in it very early.
I always wanted to do it.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So now we talked a little bit, and we got about a couple minutes before we take another break here, Michael. So you obviously have a strong background rooted in some of the more famous chefs, noted chefs here in Southeast Louisiana, as well as some time spent in Italy, time spent in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that's a great way to shape you. Let me put it this way. What started to influence you after that? And we'll have more time to get into this, but how did you bring in Southeast Asian flavors to what you're doing now and some of these things?
I think the reason is because we don't, you know, I always say New Orleans has an amazing ability of assimilation. It assimilates all of its cultures to the point where you can no longer root them out. You know, everyone here is a New Orleanian.
Like Yagamain?
Right.
I think a great example.
We take it all in. There is no Little Italy. There is no Chinatown. There is no Germantown. We have an area called the French Quarter. We have an area called German Bayou. But there's no French people there anymore. They're totally assimilated.
Yep.
But, you know, for me growing up, the only indigenous cuisine or the only ethnic cuisine that we had was Vietnamese. You know, the Hondurans were just starting to come in.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have a huge Honduran population, but at that time, if you wanted any kind of ethnic cuisine besides just New Orleans food, you had to go eat Vietnamese. And so that's what we would go eat if we didn't want New Orleans food. You know, right. My mom would take us to get, you know, because even if you go get Italian in New Orleans, it's New Orleans Italian. If you go get French, it's New Orleans French.
Right.
There's nothing purely ethnic in this town, and except for when I was growing up, it was Vietnamese food. And so that always took out to me as something different, as something fresh, as something exciting.
Not that our food
isn't great.
But different, right? Yeah, you said different flavor palette, something new.
Right. So, you know, the first time my mom brought me to get pho, I was like, this is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first time my stepdad ever brought home banh mi, I was like, this is the best pho bouillon I've ever had. Of course, I appreciate both now, but at that time, it was something totally different from what I was used to.
And something you didn't take for granted, right?
Exactly.
Well, let's do this, Michael. Let's take a quick break right here. Let's come back and talk a little bit more about that stuff. Okay. Friends, hey, we're chatting here with Chef Michael Galata from MoFo and Maypop. We're sitting here in Maypop and enjoying good lunch crowd here and chatting about stuff with Michael. We're going to talk a little bit more. Come on back.
This is Christopher Icaza, General Manager of Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street in the beautiful Vaucaray. We encourage you to come join us this fall and experience the renovation of one of the French Quarter's Grand Dames. Join us in our beautifully renovated Napoleon Dining Room. Come see our friend Paul Gustings at the beautiful Empire Bar. Experience one of the French Quarter's loveliest courtyards. That's Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street. Open 7 nights a week and every Sunday for brunch.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region. Producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay. An ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood. Or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak. To our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Hi, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. Suggesting that great handcrafted Pinot Noir from Oregon doesn't need to be expensive. Consider Yamhill Valley Vineyard Estate Pinot Noir from the oldest family estate in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. It's rich, ripe, wonderfully balanced, and it's only about $20 at your favorite New Orleans wine shop. Yamhill Valley Vineyard. Top quality doesn't need to be expensive if you know what to drink. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers!
The French Market is a place where history is made fresh daily. From the historic Upper Pontalba building on Jackson Square to the ever-evolving Farmers Market, our six-block district celebrates New Orleans food, music, and culture through events, festivals, walking tours, health and fitness classes, and also children's workshops at the New Orleans Jazz Park. Visit our calendar of events at www.frenchmarket.org. The French Market, making history fun since 1791.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe, named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner. The Black Duck features over 120 rums, as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Bageau heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Noel Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans, and the podcast interwebs wherever on planet Earth or around the United States or wherever you are listening to the show. I appreciate you tuning in. Nice little reprieve here from all of our Tales of the Cocktail coverage, chatting with Chef Michael Galata here at his spot, Maypop, downtown, and also owner of Mofo in Mid-City. And Michael, one of the things that we were talking about, and it's been a great conversation, we kind of left off with your past, more or less. I think you were at August, went right to Italy, and then you came back from Italy, and
then went to Germany.
But Chef Besh held the spot for you.
Right.
And yeah. And so you came back, and I think we touched on this a little bit, but then where'd you go from there? And then you mentioned, then you got your own spot, you started Mofo. So how did all that happen? I know it's a big story, but...
Yeah. So I was in Germany, and it was funny, I guess for Chef Besh, Germany was always sort of one of those tells, because he'd send people every year, and a lot of them just didn't last, and they'd come home in like 3 months or 4 months, and I stayed a year and a half. He had some that never came back at all. They just stayed in Germany. But you know, Katrina hit, and I was like, look, I need to come home. That's where my family's from. And he's like, yeah, I got a spot for you. And he's like, actually, I need people. You know, people can't get in. No one wants to come back. And I'm like, well, of course I'm going to come back. So I get off the plane, I walk in, and he's like, cool, you're a sous chef. Get started. I'm like, all right. I'm like, what am I doing? He's like, you're going to do all the pastries and all of the garmanger. I'm like, okay.
Wow. Okay. Instant resume builder.
Yeah, right. So and it was just something, you know, when I think back to when I first started cooking, I didn't think I could ever be good enough to get a job at August. And then suddenly I was a sous chef, and it's just one of those, like, it's lightning fast. Suddenly, okay, I'm a sous chef. So now you're just going. And I often tell people, like, my life hit just like ludicrous speed whenever I got off that plane from Germany after Katrina, because we were just like, the city was just in hyper mode. We were trying to rebuild, and we were trying, and all these doors were just opening for John, because basically only he and Donald Link, they were the only two who came back, and we're just like, we are here for the city, and we are going to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so all these doors started opening for both of them, and so things were just coming at us so fast. So I was dropping food off to people cleaning up St. Bernard in the mornings at like 6 a.m. And then I was prepping, coming back and prepping the line, and then doing service all night. And, you know, we were all running on 4 hours of sleep. And then suddenly there was a restaurant vacuum. So John started being offered all these restaurant positions, you know, Luke and then Dominica. And then he took over La Provence. And so at that time, it was expanding so quickly that people didn't have time to train with John. So he'd send them to train with me. And so if you were going to be a sous chef in the company, you had to come work for me for a little while.
Wow.
Because okay. At that point, I was John's longest standing employee. I had been with him since 2001. So I had cooked with him more than anyone, and I had worked in Germany where he had worked, and I had worked in Liguria where he was trained in Provence. I was trained in Liguria where, if you know your geography, those are walking distance from each other. And so we spoke the same food language, and before I knew it, I was Chef de Cuisine of August. You know, I spent a year just... As we were expanding, I spent a year as a sous chef, first I was Grand Marché and Pastry, then I was Banquet, then I was Executive Sous, and then I was the Chef de Cuisine. That all happened in about 11 months.
Wow. And I mean, it's for people that aren't familiar, this is a process that could actually take a lot of people years.
Right. And so suddenly I was 25 years old and I was a Chef de Cuisine at Restaurant August.
Wow.
And it was literally like battlefield promotions. This guy dropped out. Now you're this. This guy dropped out. Now you're this. And then literally, I got a call one day from Eric Lose, who is now the chef of Luke, that he was one of the sous chefs. And he's like, hey, chef just passed through the kitchen. I'm not sure where you are, but he just said that you're the Chef de Cuisine. And I'm like, okay. So okay. I showed up, and I was a Chef de Cuisine.
Wow. And a lot of figuring it out as you go, I imagine, right?
Oh, I was terrible when I first started. I was the worst. I think I almost killed about three people. Yeah. I mean, just terrible. Like, I just, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. And there was days when literally I had no sous chefs because we were expanding so quickly and they were trying to cover so many holes that, you know, Eric, who was my sous chef, would get sent over to La Provence, and like Todd Polsonelli, who was my other sous chef, who is now the Chef de Cuisine of August, would get sent over to help Alana Domenica. And so, like, I had, you know, I'd be rolling pasta while butchering meat while calling out, like, who's running out of what? Well, I had, four line cooks, and we're getting ready to go into a 150-person dinner service.
Wow.
You know, rolling foie gras, torchons, and there's no better way to learn how to cook than that.
That's trial by fire, if there is such a definition.
Yeah, and, you know, John was right in the fact that, you know, you don't learn and grow unless you're outside your comfort zone. And I spent 6 years being entirely out of my comfort zone. And it was cool. You either grow or you quit.
Right.
And there were times where I wanted to quit, and he was like, that'd be the biggest mistake of your life, and he was right. So I kept showing up, and I kept growing, and then, you know, I got to this point where, well, I talked him into letting my brother come over, because my brother was his training manager. So my brother spent years, he was the assistant general manager of Smith & Wesson Steakhouse when it was here.
Okay.
And he was a manager a manager in training for the Emerald Group, and you know.
So a lot of front of house experience.
He's all front of house.
Okay, yeah.
But after the storm, John needed people, and he's like, I know your brother works in the front of house. I'm like, yeah, he needs a job. You know, obviously Smith & Wesson didn't come back, so. You know, he doesn't, and so they brought my brother in, and my brother's like me, he'll do whatever is needed. And the first night he was washing dishes and expediting and doing whatever, and they're like, oh, so your brother works like you work. I'm like, yeah, that's kind of the way we were raised. And so he immediately became the opening general manager of the steakhouse when John reopened the steakhouse.
Yeah.
And then from there he just became the training manager for the company. And then I was like, look, my brother needs to be with me at August, because at that point he was the only one who was a tiered sommelier. And we're the only one with like extensive front of the house management from other fine dining companies. And so he and I ran August for 3 years together. He's the general manager and myself as the chef de cuisine. And every time a manager needed to be trained for somewhere else in the company, they came to us.
That's really cool. That's a great experience. Do you like working with your brother?
The good thing about working with my brother. No. I mean, my brother raised me, obviously, because he's 5 years older than me.
Okay.
And, you know, my dad passed when we were both very, very young. So. That's the thing. My brother's the greatest person to work with, because he's the devil I know. And we spent years beating on each other. So if we beat on each other a little more, we know at the end of the day, we're not going anywhere.
Right.
And that's the greatest thing. And he has the experience. You know, he can write a wine list. He can write a cocktail list. He can train a server how to do proper service. And he can do it while not even realizing that he's doing it. Which is kind of a cool thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's so well-trained in him that it just comes out naturally.
Well, I'm assuming you guys can be brutally honest with each other as well, which has its advantage. Maybe too brutally honest.
There's been a few times where things got really, really rough, mainly after the opening of MoFo, where, you know, with MoFo, we did something that neither of us had ever done. We did casual. And so, you know, at the time we got to when we were ready to leave the Besh group, we didn't know what we were doing. We just knew that, I think we were both just kind of, we were those guys, we were point man for so long, I think we were just sort of starting to come apart at the hinges. You know, the guy who leads point is always the one who's just answering all the questions and doing all the things, and it was just like, man, if we're going to do this any longer, let's just do it for ourselves. And that's kind of where it all came to a head. And another friend of ours was like, hey, I know a spot. let's go look at it. And as we were looking at it, it was literally in a strip mall in Mid-City behind a Burger King.
Yeah, Bud's
and
Broiler.
We're like, what are we going to do in this spot? And I'm like, we need to do an industry restaurant. There's no real industry restaurant in the city. There's no place where cooks and servers and bartenders can go on their day off and just be treated right and given food that, while not overly flashy, is just solid. And the cocktails are not overly flashy. They're solid, and they taste good, and they come to you fast. You know, and that was the idea behind MoFo, but we didn't know what to call it. We didn't know what it was going to be. And then we were like, well, what does your typical industry person eat on their day off? Well, the only ethnic cuisine that we have, because industry people like ethnic cuisine because it's something different than what we do all day.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so it became Vietnamese. And at the time, I didn't realize my connection with it. I was literally like... My ex-wife, who was my wife at the time, was like, what are you doing Vietnamese food? And I'm like, I don't know.
Well, Michael, can you hold that thought real quick? We'll take another quick break, and we're going to come back and close out the show here with Michael. We're talking about his story, his journey, very interesting stuff, getting involved with MoFo, and then we'll get to Maypop, where we're sitting today here on the NOLA Drink Show. Friends, come on back.
You know the sun never shines in whiskey ever.
Are you tired of drinking the same wines? Switch it up. Try the Kreutz Family Cellars wine. Kreutz Family Cellars is a small, family-owned winery in Sonoma County that makes wines from some of the most prized vineyards throughout Northern California. Each bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines has a magnolia on the label. The magnolia is a symbol of the family's southern roots and their way of life. True, honest, and fun. Look for the magnolia and pick up a bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines today.
Hi, New Orleans. It's Laura from Sobu, and I'm here with Chef Juan Carlos.
Sobu's got happier hour. It's 3 to 6 from 3 to 6.
It's bar bars, sips, and snacks, all for $3 to $6 from 3 to 6 p.m. every day.
Laura's got something to please everyone at the bar for happier hour, all for 3 to 6 here at Sobu.
And we know you'll want to try a smoky pulled pork taco or any of the other delicious snacks on our happier hour menu.
Sobu's happier hour every day from 3 to 6, 310 Charter Street in the quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time, the full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in. We're chatting with Chef Michael Galata here at his spot, Maypop, downtown New Orleans, and also the owner, chef owner of MoFo, and MoFo over there in Mid-City. And we were kind of just talking about that before the break. Your ex-wife asked you, why the hell are you opening a Vietnamese place in Mid-City?
And I said, I don't know.
And you don't know.
But once again, stepping outside your comfort zones, and I guess the... You know, we were at a crossroads, and we could either really run with it, or we could be a gimmick. And to be honest, we kind of gave it a gimmicky name. You know, we gave it a gimmicky name because we wanted the name to show that we were not going to be traditional, and we also wanted to be something people weren't going to forget. But the tricky part about that name was that if we would have just brought something gimmicky to the table, it would have looked really bad. So because we gave it that name, we had to really make it its own authentic, give it its own authenticity. And so the tricky part was really doing our homework. You know, like my business partners, my brother and my other business partner, Jeff Bybee, really spent the time, you know, learning how to make boba teas, learning how to do the Café Sudas, which we still struggle with, but spending that time, you know, in my part was to spend that time in the kitchen. And if you look at the first menu of MoFo, it was somewhat more gimmicky, but then we spent the time. We went and ate all around, and I bought a bunch of books, and I really researched, and I made myself work with things I'd never worked before, like shrimp paste and crab paste and fermented bean curd and fermented black bean paste and fermented black beans and all these things that I really had never worked with before.
Had you been to Southeast Asia at this point?
Never.
No. Okay.
No. You know, I never made a curry by hand. You know, I luckily I had some really good sous chefs who had worked with me years before and came and found me when they heard I was leaving. And they were just as integral because they were the ones that were like, you know, we bought the store bought curry paste. I'm like, this is just shit. This is shit.
Yeah.
Pardon my language.
That's right. We'll beep it.
And so we bought a mortar and pestle and we started making it by hand.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like these little things started making sense. It was like, all right, if we're going to do it, we're going to make it by hand. You know, we taught ourselves how to make roti bread by hand and we just put the work in and we tried to show someone else's culture respect. You know,
and then with your own touch and with right. your own vision.
We didn't just do it like a bunch of, and you know, one of my catchphrases was always, you know, we can't cook like white kids. We're going to do this. We can't cook like white kids. We can't cook like culinary school kids.
We'll use a term down here. You didn't carpet bag.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. We can't just go and we have to go outside of what we know and really try to make it taste good. And that became the hard part, you know, because if you open a container of fermented bean curd, it smells awful.
It does. That's very true.
But we made one of our most famous vinaigrettes, which is our roasted garlic tofu vinaigrette. It's you know, everyone's like, I need this recipe, and I'm like, and I show them what's in it, which is if the base is fermented bean curd, they're like, this is awful. I'm like, yeah, but yep. when you put it with all these other things, it becomes this umami factor,
right?
You know,
right.
when we tell everyone we don't even use salt, we use fish sauce. Everything gets seasoned with fish sauce, not salt, unless it's a vegetarian dish. And people are just like, ugh, fish sauce. I'm like, no, this is what we cook with.
I love fish sauce.
You know,
sauce.
This
yeah.
we cook with tamarind.
Absolutely.
We cook with, yeah. You know, and the first time we ever made the sum tam salad, I researched sum tam salad. I just researched the hell out of it, and I walked in one day with a earthenware mortar and pestle, a tom tom, and they're like, and my cook's like, what are you doing? I'm like, this is going to be our new salad on the menu. We'd already been open for four months or so when I put the sum tam on. Now that's our house salad at MoFo. And I made it one from scratch, and I let everyone try it, you know, pounding the dried shrimp, pounding the garlic, pounding the palm sugar and the tamarind water and with the chilies. And I made it all from scratch. And I said, well, but we're not going to do it with green papaya. We're going to do it with whatever's coming from the farm.
That's cool. Okay.
And it's going to change with the seasons.
Yeah.
You know, and I let everyone try it, and they were like, oh, my God. And then it became, it was all of these little lightning rod moments, one after the other, where it was like, okay, if we're gonna do a curry, we're gonna do it in a mortar and pestle from scratch, and that, you know, that became a defining thing about our company. If we're gonna do the sometimes salad, it's gonna be done every order from scratch in the mortar and pestle, like it's done in Southeast Asia.
So Michael, I think this is really fascinating because it's honoring the process,
right.
sort of finding these keystone parts of the recipe,
right.
through process and ingredient, and then creatively imbuing it with fresh, local,
exactly.
and the sensibility of local sensibility.
And then once we got that down, then it became this sort of, as we did more of the research, we noticed like, okay, these are very similar cultures. We're both ex-French colonies,
yep.
you know, or post-colonial French colonies. We're both brackish water river deltas.
Mm-hmm.
We're both
tropical,
we're subtropical.
Right, right.
And so, you know, and that suddenly there was all of these similarities. And so if you take the similarities and then start plugging in the disparate parts, and then suddenly you have something that is in its own right authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was what became the driving force. Like, how can we, you know, like every time I would go eat fermented black bean braised crab or fermented black bean braised lobster, it reminded me of the flavor of gumbo. So then we started doing a gumbo where we added fermented black bean to the gumbo, and it made it something that people could recognize, but totally different. And they're like, so New Orleanians are like, I recognize this, but it's not what I grew up with, but it's good. And then, you know, so now when I make gumbo, it always has fermented black bean in it. And then we started going one step further. I put lemongrass in my gumbo. I also put lime leaf.
I also put
cassia bark.
Okay.
And it's all these little things where at the end of the day, it's a gumbo. And it looks like a gumbo, but when you taste it, you're like, there's so many other things going on here.
In building these flavor bridges, right, for people.
Right. And so, but all it is just a further of New Orleans cuisine. New Orleans cuisine assimilates all cultures. You know, just like our andouille is not an andouille yet from France. It's a German smoked sausage. But the Germans stole the andouille name because they knew that they could sell it. And so they took the best of both worlds, and they took the best of their world and the best of the French bits and pieces, but they knew how to hot smoke. So they took all the good stuff and put it in a casing and hot smoked it. And we call it andouille, but it's a German sausage.
German sausage.
So it's the exact same process.
Interesting. That's really cool, man. You know, and because we only have, well, we have about 3-4 minutes left, Michael, and I want to get to Maypop a little bit.
Okay, so then, so MoFo was open.
Yep.
And luckily enough, we got some pretty big awards, national and local.
And we'll have to get, I'm going to have you back on the show, man, because we didn't touch on, you know, your rising star, best new chef, and food and wine. And
all of those things.
You had some experience on TV. Will you come back on the show to talk about more of that stuff? Okay, right on, man. But go on, say what you're going to say.
So, well, that was the thing. It all happened very quickly. So in my mind, I always thought, well, we opened MoFo. MoFo will be the one that we can get some money in the bank, and then we can open the one that will win the awards. But then MoFo started winning awards, which we didn't. We never intended any of that. And so MoFo started winning these awards, and suddenly, well, we thought we could pull off another spot. And, you know, the spot, and we turned a lot of things down. We didn't really want to do a second restaurant yet. But when the Maypop spot opened, when we looked at it, it already had the infrastructure. All we had to do was walk in, do a makeover, a facelift, and we had a restaurant. So the price was right. The location was
turnkey
right.
Turnkey is good.
Turnkey is great when you're, because we don't have a huge backer. We had someone give us some seed money.
Okay.
And that seed money is what we used to grow MoFo. You know, we put our houses on the line. We put everything we owned on the line. It's our company. We owe a bank a ton of money. And so now we owe a bank even more money. Right. You know, so it's not like we have anyone to bail us out. We got, you know, MoFo has stayed in the black since we opened it. And we did it by doing all the side hustles. Like, if you know, we do the food at Finn McCool's Irish Pub, and we do the food at Trejo, and we do the catering for Latrobes. Those are our side hustles mm-hmm. that help pay the debt down on the big restaurants mm-hmm. so we can keep the big restaurants in the black. You know, and you have to approach it from a different perspective if you don't have a huge company behind you or you don't have a huge backer behind you. It has to stay in the black. So you have to cook differently. It has to be right. You have to be able to change on a dime and make sure that what the customer gets is something that they're going to come back for. And so when we opened Maypop, you know, they were like, oh, we'll just do a downtown MoFo. And I'm like, I think this needs to be something different. And I still don't even know if I'm right. We're only 7 months in. But the idea was like, let's actually pull from all of our, you know, we have so much experience between the three of us, my three business partners, or my two business partners and myself. We've got collectively, you know, 60 years of restaurant experience. So let's bring back something a little higher end. Let's bring back the wine list. Because we had people like, my brother and I had fans of ours when we left August that came to MoFo and they're like, this is not what we want.
Right.
y'all used to do like really nice food.
Where's the French wine list?
Right. And so we're like, well, let's open something that bridges that gap. You know, let's really geek out. Let's do something where we can run a bottle list, a small bottle list with some really cool wines, some slightly nicer cocktails, some nicer stemware, some nicer plateware, a nicer location. You know, we'll put a little aging cave in for some nice charcuterie, and let's just see what happens.
Michael, we gotta cut it all here, right, pretty quick. So tell people really quickly where we can find you online and where the two restaurants are address-wise.
So MoFo is on City Park Avenue, right across from City Park. If you want to go online, it's mofonola.com. Maypop is our new baby. She is downtown. She is on O'Keefe, the corner of O'Keefe and Lafayette, so right down this, right off of Poitras, right by the Superdome.
611 O'Keefe.
611 yep. O'Keefe. And then it is maypoprestaurant.com. Go check it out. Come get some food.
Awesome. And good drink and all that. And Michael, again, I'd love to have you back on the show so we can go further down this.
That sounds good.
Awesome. Friends, we were just chatting with Chef Michael Galati here at his spot, Maypop, also chef owner of MoFo. Thanks for being here, man. I really appreciate it. Friends, thanks for tuning in to the Noel Drink Show. And until next week, cheers, y'all.